Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, concerns about the price and also the availability of oil have been leading more and more people to look for renewable alternatives. In this first part of the show, we'll talk a bit about the potential for turning plant material into liquid fuel for transportation. There are other kinds of things that come under the heading of biofuels. There are certainly natural and renewable sources that can be used to power industry. There are ways that you can turn this kind of material, also things like used vegetable oil and animal fats, into other kinds of oils. Sometimes people have experimented with using them to heat their homes, but I think that a lot of the attention is concentrated on the need to do something about our dependence on oil, and on imported oil particularly, and that's where we look at the possibility for biofuel. So we'll be talking a little bit about that here in this first hour of Focus 580, and of course invite questions. And we have three guests here with us. Hans Blaschek is professor of food microbiology. He is also assistant dean in the College of ACES here at the U of I. Huimin Zhou is assistant professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering, and Steve Long is the Robert Emerson professor of plant biology and crop science here at the U of I. All of them interested in the topic and come at it from slightly different directions, and we'll give all of them a chance to talk and answer questions here in this first part of the show. The number, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it. Just in the very basic, the most basic way, I guess, here now what we're talking about is taking some kind of plant material, something that was once living, and there are going to be a range of things that you can use, and we can talk about what some of those things are. But basically, as I understand it, what we're talking about is taking these various things and using them to produce alcohol, a kind of alcohol that can be used all by itself, can be blended with other sorts of things. Basically, is that at the simplest possible way, that's what we're talking about?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. I think so.
Okay. What now, there are different feedstocks that you can use to do this. And different places around the world, they've chosen to emphasize different things. At our part of the country, corn is a big source. In Brazil, they're using sugarcane. There are other places that they're using other things. What sorts of things could you use if you decided you were going to take the plant material, you were going to convert it, you can use it to make it alcohol to use for transportation? What are the range of things that you could use to do this?
Well, right now, I mean, starch is sort of king, if you will. There's a lot of history to using starch, and cornstarch in particular. And it's a substrate that people understand, know how to use, and the technology is well developed. But actually, there's lots of potential for using sort of the rest of the corn stalk, if you will. Mm-hmm. And when you start talking about co-products, that tends to be pretty exciting because, right now, most of that material is plowed back into the fields. And so instead of doing that, one can think about actually using that material as a starting point for making other types of liquid fuels.
Yeah, I just add to that, because you mentioned Brazil, and of course what they're doing there with sugarcane is they actually have the sugar, so they're extracting the sugar in the way that it's always been done in the past, and then from that sugar they can go straight to ethanol production. Mm-hmm. We, in the temperate zone, for example, in the Midwest, we obviously can't grow sugarcane, but there is interest in growing sweet sorghum, which is one crop which could generate sugar directly, although at present the yields are rather small. But perhaps one of the breakthroughs, which is allowing us to use almost any sort of plant material, whether it's dried grass or wood chips, is the production of very cheap cellulase. This is an enzyme which will break down the cellulose structure of plants into sugars. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, from there you can go to ethanol. So this has opened up and many more possibilities. And of course, this was central to the president's speech, where he mentioned about obtaining ethanol from wood chips and switchgrass and so on.
Yeah. And I know that you have been interested in a plant that I think is related to switchgrass, this miscanthus, which is a very tall grass that could be grown expressly for that purpose.
Yes. So our interest in Miscanthus is the fact that it is so productive, so that it produces so much biomass per acre, because if you look at the enormity of the task, you know, a major challenge is simply obtaining enough biomass to then replace petroleum. And that's our interest in Miscanthus.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the, I think, probably one of the big questions that is, people talk about this as something that will help ease our dependence on oil. And we're importing a lot of our oil now. But we use so much of it, you would have to ask the question, well, just how much ethanol could we hope to produce? And given how much oil we use, would that really put much of a dent in our oil consumption or the demand we have for oil?
I think the current annual production for ethanol is about 4.5 billion per year. And the total fraction of energy needed for the United States is about $140 billion gallons of gasoline. And of course, that's only a small percentage. However, if we can use other biomaterials like the switchgrass or wood chips, and also we use more advanced technologies to convert those materials to ethanol more efficiently, I think in the end, it can put a dent.
Yeah. Well, Brazil, they're actually talking about being able to grow enough sugarcane and produce enough ethanol to power all of their cars, right? They're talking about actually being free of oil for that particular purpose.
Right. There is a study that was carried out by the Department of Energy which actually looked at the total amount of biomass that could be available in the U.S. It's called the Billion Ton Study, B as in Bob, mm-hmm. and it's actually 1.3 billion tons.
Yes.
Tons of material, mm-hmm. right, that could be made available and would not have an impact, say, on our food supply or other alternative uses. So when you think about it, you know, co-products like Stover or the rest of the corn plant, if you will, that now gets plowed back into the field, that actually represents a very large quantity of biomass. And yes, there are questions about how it impacts soil for fertility were that to be done. That is, were all that material to be removed and no longer plowed back in. But there are even studies that show even if 50% of that material were used, that would still have a rather dramatic impact. So if you consider all that material that right now is just rotting or isn't being used very efficiently, then it seems to me that the projection for how biofuels could play a role can actually be fairly significant.
Yeah. Well, the number that I have seen, and you can tell me if this is correct, of all of the energy produced here in the United States, 4% comes from biomass. And I guess that also would be that would include the industrial applications as well. So we're not just talking about something like ethanol. We're talking about paper companies that manage to use their waste and convert that into energy.
But, you know, given the very strong interest right now in liquid fuels as energy, the point has been made that biomass is really one of the few sources that can contribute to liquid fuels. It's very difficult, for example, to take solar, and convert it into a liquid fuel. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are other forms of renewable energy as well. But biomass does have this fairly unique niche, if you will, that allows it to be converted into a liquid fuel, which I think is why all the interest.
Mm. Well, what sort of predictions or projections is anybody making? If you ask this question, what do you think it could be? So if biomass is today, if it's 4% of the energy produced in the United States, what do you think if we took it as far as it could go, what do you think that could be?
Practically, I think the numbers that I have seen, again, these are projections, but 30%.
30%.
Mm. That's right. Yeah, I saw in an article. Yeah.
Yeah, the billion-ton vision that Professor Blaschek referred to, is the projection there is that 30% of liquid fuel could be replaced from biomass sources. But actually, the number could be higher because that doesn't really take account of how research might be able to push this forward. For example, if we talk about crops such as miscanthus or switchgrass, these are almost essentially wild plants which have been taken in and started to use as crops. If we start to apply the technology we're applying to food crops to these, we could be looking at considerably higher yields from those crops. Mm. So I think 30% may be more of a starting point, and we could go to higher numbers than that.
Well, I tell you what, we have, there's other questions. Many occur to me, but I do have a couple of callers here who are ready to go to talk with us. So let's do that. You'll need to put on your headphones there so you can hear them. Questions are invited. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe I'll just again reintroduce the guest. The last person you heard, that's Stephen Long. He's professor of plant biology and crop science. Also with us, Huimin Jo. He is an assistant professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering. And Hans Blaschek, he's professor of food microbiology. All of them here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. We have several callers, so let's talk first with someone over in Indiana. And this is line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I've listened to a number of discussions and programs talking about biomass, and everything is just hunky-dory, basically. And I'd like to go at the other end of it. I know corn ravages the soil, which means we're going to have more nitrogen and all those other good things that go in the air that we breathe. And I just wondered, is there anything negative about this situation other than people won't be able to accelerate 0 to 60 in 3 seconds anymore with the ethanol in their car? And which, you know, one may, you know, grin about it, but that's an important factor in American manhood. I know that for sure. And I'm wondering about that, but I just wonder if we start moving to the tall grasses and things like that, this, what are we going to do to the environment? I have never heard anybody, government, state, city, local, farmers, or anything, talk about, you know, let's put it in this way, depletion factor. And if there is one, I'd like to know about it. And if there isn't one, why? Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, you want to take that one on?
Well, if we move to the tall grasses, part of the motivation behind this is if we're considering biomass for energy, we need to minimize the amount of energy we use in that production. The advantage of these tall perennial grasses is that they require relatively little nitrogen, because in the fall they move their nitrogen back below ground, then they're harvested in the winter when essentially they're dead and dry. So the feedstock is this dead dry biomass. So that gives it an advantage in terms of nitrogen. Because they're perennial, they're also putting carbon into the soil, so they could actually be valuable in situations where the carbon has been worked out of the soil. There are fairly extensive stands of these that are in production in Europe, and generally the environmental benefits have been considered substantial.
The caller raises this issue of the environmental impact. That's one particular big issue that has been raised. Something else, and I know this is controversial, particularly as it applies to corn ethanol, is this question of energy in, energy out. Depending upon who you ask, some people will tell you that to produce corn ethanol actually takes more energy than you get back. Some people will say, well, that's not true. You do gain some energy, but you don't gain very much. So you put in a lot, you get that back plus a little bit more. And I'm sure that this is one of those things, if you get a group of scientists together, you could have an argument and they could go at it for a long period of time. Generally speaking, then, about, say, make that comparison. Say, let's compare corn ethanol, and you compare ethanol that would be produced from, say, switchgrass or miscanthus that you've looked at. What do you think about that energy in, energy out question? And actually, I guess I'm also interested in what you think about the energy in, energy out questions about corn ethanol, too.
Yeah. So we had a symposium in April, and Michael Wang from Argonne came down. This happens to be his area of expertise. And I think he actually addressed this in what I thought was a very interesting sort of a way, drawing a circle which shows sort of the universe of what one considers in terms of what the inputs are and what the outputs might be. But really, what from a very straightforward sort of a way, what brought this home to me, and again, this is not something I'm an expert in, but I have seen, I've been at a number of meetings where actually investigators have talked about this. What's interesting about this is that I'm told, for example, a gallon of gasoline, you know, I mean, you can say, why is this question even coming up at this point? Okay. A gallon of gasoline, as I understand it, takes about a gallon of gasoline to produce. So if you want to talk about net energy, if you want to talk about what it takes to produce products, you know, Michael sort of raised the issue. You know, what does it take to produce electricity, for example? What is the net energy sort of condition under which that operates? So, yes, it's true that that ethanol, you know, has inputs, that if you're going to make corn ethanol, you have to expend some energy. But the real question, it seems to me, is why are people even asking this question? Because why aren't they asking it for other products as well?
Hmm. Well, what about the question then if you make the comparison? You say you'd think about look at the things that we could use to produce the ethanol. Hmm. Does it make more sense to look at cellulosic ethanol than it would be to starch ethanol in terms of mm-hmm. what it takes to produce it and then when you get back?
Sure. I mean, the cost of the substrate and is a major factor anytime you're trying to convert something from one form to another. And if you start with something like cellulosic materials, which by and large could have very low cost or even in some cases a net negative cost, there's that net word again, that can contribute to the result, okay, and people have shown that when you start with cellulosic materials that the net energy balance looks a lot better than if you start with starch as the material.
I would add that certainly if you look at the energy inputs in going from corn to ethanol, then there's the energy that's used on the farm. Nitrogen is quite a large amount of energy because we need energy to produce that nitrogen fertilizer. Mm-hmm. The number of times the tractor has to cross the field, then the next step is transport to the ethanol plant, and then the major cost is actually in distilling the ethanol. Now, we can improve that system, for example, by adding in the stover. So that is essentially now energy for free, which is not taken account of at present in these costs. So that will be a gain. Another area, of course, is looking at alternative products that bugs can make from the material. If we could make something which is lipophilic, this is sort of like an oil, then it would separate from the water without having to use any energy. And so we should bear in mind that if we're willing to apply research and development investment, that we do have alternative routes that would cut down considerably on the caller's concern. Hmm.
So it sounds as if what you're saying is that we right now have a kind of a chemical process to use to separate out the stuff that we want, that if you could essentially develop some kind of microorganism that would do that job for you, then that wouldn't require the energy input that it would now if you use it. If you use the kind of traditional sort of chemical process that is available?
Well, we are using, I mean, typically bugs are used to produce the alcohol. Uh-huh. And of course, that's something where we have a long history of technology. But
fermentation process.
Yeah. But there are bugs, and Professor Blachek is the expert on this. There are bugs that can make many other products. So if we make an oil to start with, that will separate out from the water, whereas because alcohol mixes with water, you then have a major energy input to separate those two.
So basically what Steve said is that develop a better method for separation.
Well, we have a number of other callers, and rather than make these people wait while we chat, why don't we go ahead and get some more questions from them, and next would be someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have an answer to the gentleman's question about, and then other questions, but why the economy is questioned is that in Champaign County right now we've got the possibility, or at least the rumor, that the idle capital is could come in and build one or two corn ethanol plants. Corn-fueled ethanol plants or corn-processing ethanol plants. And frankly, There's a lot of us who've seen, in decades, have seen these boom cycles where something like the price of oil hitting three or four times its original level inspires, you know, pursuits for corn oil or grass oil or snake oil. You've got a job. There's a lot of research to be done. And frankly, some of what you necessarily do to sell your place in this research to find money for it is going to appear a lot like promotion. You better have reasonable and honest answers. And my questions, though, have to do with just how weedy this grass is. Where does it grow originally? I understand it is a perennial. Does it propagate by seeding in addition to rooting? If I plant it next to my pet 3 1/3 acre native prairie, how soon am I going to have to be beating it back from the perimeter?
Well, the billion-ton vision actually was based on switchgrass, which is a native prairie grass. The other grass we're talking about, which is considerably more productive, is miscanthus.
That's the one I'm interested in.
Okay, yeah, miscanthus that has been used fairly extensively in biomass projects in Europe is actually a cross between two different species. So it's rather like crossing a horse with a donkey and obtaining a mule. They have an uneven number of chromosomes, which prevents it from producing any fertile seeds. This is a fairly well-known technology. It's the one that's used, for example, in bananas. If you ever had a fertile banana, you'd have a seed in it that's like a bullet, and you'd probably break your tooth on it. But that's never happened, and so the banana industry has used this technology for many years. There have been stands of this grass in Denmark for over 30 years, and they haven't found any invasion problems with that. We've had a stand here on the turf farm since 1987, and it's remained where it was planted, so we're very doubtful that there's any weediness problem.
Yes, it propagates then by what, roots?
It's planted, you have to plant rhizomes.
I see, so they pretty much stay in the place where each one is planted.
Yes, we don't have evidence that they spread. It's also not Roundup ready, so it's very easy to get rid of if you need to do that.
Okay. The other question, where is it in the food web in terms of local animals? Deer munch on anything, as do rabbits, but since it doesn't bear seeds, it's of no interest to animals that eat seeds.
No, it appears some rabbits may actually chew on the new leaves when it first emerges, but beyond that, it doesn't appear to be eaten by anything. It provides cover from about April right the way through until January, February time, so you find quite a few nesting birds in there. They're obviously not using the plant material itself as their source of food, but it does provide cover for wild animals in a way.
Ground nesting birds.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And we've also found some nests actually lodged above the ground in the vegetation as well.
I'll get off, but could you describe the plant?
Yes, it looks fairly similar to reed, except it grows taller, quite a bit taller than reed. It will grow up to about 12 to 14 feet.
Hmm. Just to pick up real quick on another point the caller made, and then I promise the folks who are remaining will get on to them. It's the issue of economics. Right now, there's a great deal of interest in renewable sources of energy, partly because we have oil at $70 a barrel. But what if oil went back down to 40? Or 30, you know, we may never see that again. But if that happened, then would biofuel still make sense, or would we suddenly be finding ourselves with something that couldn't compete?
I think it does make sense. I think that for every sort of barrel, if you will, of biofuel that's produced, you're displacing some petroleum-based biofuel, and that or petroleum-based fuel, and so, you know, that I think has real impact. And you know, Professor Long sort of alluded to this earlier, that there are, you know, ethanol, I think, is really just the beginning. Ethanol is an alcohol. It happens to be the alcohol that's being produced now using fairly traditional technology. But we can see that the economics of this could improve fairly dramatically as we move into other higher value products, some of which will also be alcohols, which will have functionality, if you will, that ethanol doesn't have right now, and application that ethanol doesn't have right now. So, for example, one can think of products that are being produced by various companies right now that are used in polymer production. They're used in producing fibers for clothing, and they're all based on renewables.
Okay. Our guest here in this part of Focus 580, Hans Blaschek. He's professor of food microbiology. He's also assistant dean in the College of ACES. Weiman Joe, he's assistant professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering. Steve Long is a professor of plant biology and crop science. We're talking about biofuels, and we have several callers here. Lines are full, so let's get back to it. And next is Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. The first two callers, to a large extent, kind of already got to what I was wanting to ask, but I want to see us, you know, get away from fossil fuels. That's very important. And I have to say that, I've long been skeptical about getting ethanol from corn, not only because of the issue of mining the soil, but there's lots of, you know, even fossil fuel inputs into creating the corn in the first place. And beyond that, you know, I think we need to be asking questions about the impact on our water supply of these big ethanol plants and many, many things. But I think I really like your question about why are we, you know, asking about, you know, the cost of, you know, producing other fuels. And I think beyond that, we're not thinking in fundamental enough ways about not only what we're going to use to, say, fuel our vehicle and our warmer houses and other things like that. You know, we're not thinking enough about, you know, the power plants that you know, drive the cars, but you know, we also need to be even asking questions about what we're building our cars out of. You know, I mean, they're so heavy that it takes a lot of energy to move them. If a car weighed half or even 30% of what it does now, you know, it would be a lot easier. It would take a lot less, you know, input to move it said distance. And, you know, so we need to be asking a lot more fundamental questions about that. And I guess you know, just trying to move things in terms of maybe addressing, you know, all these issues on a somewhat more fundamental level. And so that's part of what bothers me a little bit about, you know, this whole ethanol thing, even though, you know, perhaps the grasses and things are less, you know, weight on the environment than, you know, corn. But that's, I'd like to kind of have you.
Okay. Well, you want to pick up on those comments in any way you Why?
I think one way to think about it is that where we are today with the production of ethanol is at the very beginning of what could ultimately be a very sophisticated biorefinery. If you think about what happens on the petroleum side, they're very sophisticated in the way, as I understand, what they do with a barrel of petroleum and all the products that are made from it. But there's a multiplicity of products that are produced. And I understand that they use pretty much every drop of that material. So I could envision, and others have talked about this, that in the future we'll see a biorefinery which is a takeoff, if you will, of where we are today with a dry mill that produces just ethanol. And we're going to see other products being produced of higher value, perhaps even having higher octane value than ethanol does, and having characteristics, chemical and other types of characteristics that make it more amenable to various types of processes. So I think, you know, we're at the very early part of this process, and we could see it maturing to the point where the petroleum industry is in many ways. And I think there are lessons to be learned there. And yes, you know, it's the environment issue, which a number of callers have raised now. I mean, I think that biomass and the environment really do go together in many ways. And yes, it's not – just because it's green doesn't necessarily mean that it's without some problems. But I think that in the end of the day, I think it offers some opportunities to us, which from an environmental standpoint is going to sort of supersede what we see on the petrochemical side.
Okay.
Yeah. I should add, too, to sort of amplify what Professor Blachek has just said on the environment, that, of course, another motivation and to this is the issue of global change, that if we use renewable energy, then we're decreasing the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting in the atmosphere, which is considered to be the major driver of global change.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll go on. Let's go next to Lovington. This is line four. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. If I understand you correctly, you're talking about the possibility of using corn stalks for ethanol?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, this may be a dumb question, but after you harvest a field of corn, you've got a field covered with loose corn stalks. So how are you going to get them off the field to the plant? I mean, where the ethanol is made.
Well, the view is that these would be baled, and the bales would be transported to the ethanol plant.
You mean you could just use a baler? I mean, I've never heard of baling corn stalks, but I suppose it could be done.
Yeah, it would obviously require some development, but that is the idea in the USDA's report on the billion-ton vision.
Ah, I see. Okay, but it would take some kind of modified equipment. In other words, you couldn't just take the baler that you use for alfalfa or whatever.
Yes, I believe it would require modification.
I see. Well, I kind of assumed that somebody had thought about this, but I had never heard anything about it.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Back here to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
My question is about my car, which is a traditional gasoline engine. And are we going to be able to use ethanol 85 or any other alternate fuel in that traditional gasoline engine, or is there going to be a way to have some mechanism that can adapt a gasoline engine to the new fuels?
So I would check with the manufacturer of your car.
Well, I did, but they kind of shook their heads.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, this is not an area that I'm, you know, really an expert in, but from what I mean, there are certain vehicles that are known as flex fuel vehicles,
mm-hmm.
and it should be so indicated, you know, on the automobile, and in fact, I think some manufacturers show it right on the gas cap. But I do understand, I mean, that there have been various tests carried out, and E85, for example, can work in automobile engines with fairly minor modifications to engines. So it's not that dramatic a change. What seems to be sort of the limitation here is the infrastructure, having the pumps and the gas stations that in fact are able to deliver the E85.
There's one out on Philo Road, isn't there? Philo in Florida, don't they have a E85?
I'm not sure about the specific location, but I think that around Champaign-Urbana,
yeah.
you can buy it. You can't buy it a lot of places, but I believe that you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, I have a Honda Civic SI hatchback, and so it's too old for it, and I hate to think of having to buy a new car just to use the new fuels.
Well, that you definitely have to check with Honda and see. It's sort of my understanding that here, I think all of the gasoline in the state of Illinois now has 10% ethanol, and
yeah,
that any
right.
car can run on that. But I think definitely if your manufacturer or your owner's manual doesn't say that you can use more ethanol than that, don't do it. And then you can pursue that further with you know, whoever made
the. Well, I didn't get a very good answer from them. So that's why I was asking you.
Oh, well, it could be that they don't know, or that they're not.
Well,
they're sure.
Very hesitant.
Yeah.
And they say, well, there's things that other fuels could maybe destroy the tubes or something.
of hoses.
Yeah, I kind of think that that's the issue.
Yeah. Okay, well, right. Thank you.
Well, maybe on some future program we can get at that a little bit better. And let's go to the campus here, line number 3. Hello.
Hello, am I on the air?
Yes.
Hi, I want to thank you and your guests for having this discussion. I recently heard an interesting argument that I wanted to repeat for your guests and see what they thought. And this regards the linkage of ethanol prices with gasoline prices and the effect on commodities like food and beef, all kinds of things that rely upon corn as an input, and whether or not we're going to end up with $7 hamburgers if we switch over to ethanol.
Well, what about that?
Certainly this is an issue which is discussed a great deal, but we perhaps have to sort of bear in mind that the price of corn that many farmers in the Midwest are getting at present is about the same price per bushel that their grandparents obtained. So many in the agricultural industry may argue that it's underpriced, and like anyone who's got an underpriced commodity, you need to look at alternative markets, which is exactly what has been happening with the ethanol industry.
But if I just might add that it appears that we're not just facing $3 a gallon gasoline now, but maybe $4, $5, $6 a gallon gasoline. And certainly we might expect ethanol prices to double as it becomes more of a substitute for gasoline. Anyway, I have no expertise, but it seemed like a reasonable argument to entertain.
Yes, I think it may be a very important factor in maintaining the viability of agriculture in the Midwest. Without this, we're looking at a situation where the world supply of corn is rising. Prices could, for example, drop without this. So it is could be very important for our region.
All right. Thank you very much. Right.
And I'm sure that some people will also raise the question about it goes to this issue of what kind of stock you're going to use to produce your ethanol. Does it really make sense to take corn that you can essentially make into food products and take that and use some of that to make alcohol when you can make it out when you make alcohol of something else that you can't do anything else with? You can't eat your miscanthus, so you might as well take that and make it an alcohol. Does it make sense that to use certain kinds of things for one purpose and other things for another purpose?
And I think that's exactly the argument for using co-products. Yeah.
But I probably should also add in the billion-ton vision from USDA and the Department of Energy that we've referred to. There, for example, they pointed out corn can only take us so far. Using corn starch can only take us a small part of the way to replacing this 30% of petroleum. So we have to turn to alternatives like switchgrass, using corn stover, and so on.
No, okay. Well, we have about 15 minutes left. And anything that anybody wants to add at this point? Otherwise, we can go on and talk some other calls.
Yeah, I think this idea of cornstarch as being an area and there's a lot of expertise, there's a lot of knowledge in how to convert starch into alcohol. I think the real challenge for us in the future as investigators trying to figure this out is really taking the long view, because co-product utilization like cellulosics or lignocellulosic materials are just frankly not that easy to convert into other products. I mean, that really is where I think we as investigators can make a contribution. So that's the long view. The short view, I think, is, okay, we can do this with starch and it works, but can we do it with products that have, co-products that have millions of years evolved to be resistant to degradation? And here we are trying to figure out how to make them more amenable, say, to fermentation and to breakdown. And so I think that's really where I see us as trying to make a contribution.
Well, is that something that, chemically speaking, is very complicated? Is this a big puzzle, deciding how you can take something like miscanthus and not only manage to take that and make it into alcohol, but make it into a lot of other things? I mean, is that a big challenge?
I think it is. It is a challenge. I mean, we're seeing it now with products that are produced as a result of making ethanol. I mean, there is residue that's left over. And right now, this material, it's frankly the stuff the yeast don't want to eat. You know, it's leftover. It settles to the bottom of the reaction vessel. And what do you do with this material is kind of the question. Mm. And right now, they're sort of moving it around in end loaders and trying to find a use for it, and it's used as animal feed. But there's only so many animals that you can feed with this material, and then you have excess material. So one of the things that we've been looking at is to try and figure out how to use this material to make something else that some other microbe might find particularly palatable and can convert into something else.
I think I'd add to that, really, that it's important to realize that we may be only looking at the tip of the iceberg of possibilities. That a previous caller sort of mentioned about, well, we're trying to support this area of research. But I think as a nation, we need to bear in mind that there's huge potential here. And we really need to get to grips with, you know, exactly what the potential is, what the best opportunities are, if we want to be secure in our energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some other folks we can talk with. Let's do that. And we'll go next to someone in Champaign, line number two.
Hi, I want to answer the question that one of the guests posed a while back, and that is, why is anybody asking if there's any net gain in energy? And the reason is that ethanol is being touted as renewable, and if it takes as much petroleum product to produce the ethanol as is gained, then you cannot tout it as renewable. And as far as I know, it's very difficult to find any honest figures on how much energy is gained. On this station, recently on the Afternoon Ag show, in the first half of the show, there was a lot of whining about the price of petroleum and what's that doing to the cost of inputs. And then in the second half, touting ethanol as renewable. You can't have both. And my question is, as far as fermenting other things, finding the right enzymes to ferment other things, and maybe possibly reducing the amount of energy needed, standard energy sources needed, to cut out the distilling, which I know takes a lot of the energy, wouldn't you still, I mean, all these enzymes are going to need a certain temperature and need a lot of water, aren't you still going to have a big energy cost? Because you're going to have to keep huge vats at a certain temperature and so on.
Well, can somebody talk about that?
Yeah, actually, if you look at the overall ethanol production process, it requires several steps. The first step is the biomass is degraded to fermentable sugars. And then the second step is to use the microorganisms like yeast to ferment those sugars to ethanols. Mm-hmm. And the third step, of course, is to purify that ethanol by distillation.
Right.
And if the ethanol concentration is very low, it is true that it requires lots of energies. That makes the overall process not economical. That's the reason why ethanol, the cost of ethanol is still high, which requires actually tax subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can engineer the microorganisms to produce more ethanols, so someone said that instead of making beer, if we can make wine or vodka, so then the cost of produced ethanol will be significantly reduced. And also, if we can use other materials, like those cellulosic materials, and those could be in a negative value, so then we can reduce the overall cost of ethanol as well.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Energy had a sort of a challenge program, if you will, because when they looked at the process, it was clear that the cost of enzymes was a major factor in whether something would produce this way could be economically viable. And Novozymes and I guess Genencore were the recipients of or were the ones that actually carried out the work. And at the end of the day, or actually after a few years of research, they have been able to bring down the cost of those enzymes, I believe, on the order of 100-fold. So that's already making progress in that direction.
Yeah, but I'm talking about all these enzymes are going to work at a certain temperature range. You can't just have them out in a frozen building in the winter and expect them to work. You're still going to have huge plants that take a lot of energy to run to keep these big vats of things that are fermenting at a certain temperature. You're always going to have a lot of energy input to produce this stuff. And you have to be honest about, is there any net energy gain? And right now, I don't see any honesty here. Right now, you cannot tout ethanol as renewable, because if you live anywhere near Decatur, you know that coal trucks are on the road heading for ADM 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And burning coal produces a lot more CO2 than burning other things. I mean, it takes a lot of water also to produce ethanol. I just don't think anybody's being honest about, you know, this product.
Well, if it,
I'll
further
hang up and listen to your response.
Well, you want to comment on that any further?
I'd say that, I mean, this is an area about which there's a huge amount of discussion. The energy input versus the energy output from corn ethanol. And I agree with the caller that it is very difficult to get to grips with the arguments that are put forward on both sides. I think it's clear to all of us that there probably is some energy gain, but it's not huge. So the caller is right that you can't call all of this ethanol renewable. But what we should look at is, as Professor Blachek said, the challenge is how can we improve the efficiency of each step? As the caller mentioned, coal is commonly used for the distillation step. But in fact, as we mentioned, there's quite a lot of residue left over, which is also combustible. So if there are incentives for example, ethanol producers to use this residue rather than coal for the distillation step, then that would start to make this more and more renewable. On the issue of enzymes, if you can replace a chemical, purely chemical process with an enzyme process, then you always have a considerable gain of energy, because it's effectively what enzymes are doing are reducing the amount of energy required for a given conversion. That's how they work. So the energy input for an enzyme catalyzed process is very much smaller.
All right. Well, let's try to get at least one more caller in the time that we have here. Chicago, next, line four. Hello.
I've got two comments. What are we going to do when our population reaches a half a billion? And the other question is, what was the process the Germans used in World War II for their fuel supply?
Well, the first question, I think, is one for another show. The second question, is that something that you can talk about?
No, this is way outside my area of expertise. My understanding is that they used a process which is used occasionally today to convert coal into oil, but it's pretty inefficient, requires a great deal more energy to obtain your gallon of oil.
Let's go on then to Mattoon, to another caller. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think the biggest problem here is just the misinformation, or people are just now starting to dig and find this information. But here at our farm, we've used that 10% ethanol and biodiesel for years, and it's a fantastic product. It really works, and people have not mentioned anything about the poor farmer out here that still has $2 corn like he's had for decades. And we're using less and less fuel with minimum till, no till. As far as the question about corn stalks, we bale corn stalks with our baler every year. And it's just the same baler we use to bale our hay. We bale up the corn stalks and we use it for bedding and feed for the cows. It takes no modifications at all. But also remember that there's a nutrient value with corn stalks or using wheat straw or those kind of things. It has a nutrient value. So that has to be taken into consideration. If you take that off to use, it has a nutrient value there.
You mean to the soil, yeah?
Yeah, to the soil. Mm-hmm. It's you would not have to add commercial fertilizers if you leave that there.
Right, and as I understand it, there have been a number of studies done looking at that. One at Iowa State that comes to mind, and trying to determine, you know, is there a level that can be used, that can be removed without having a negative impact on soil fertility is the question.
But the ethanol, we've been watching this thing grow for years, and we've become more and more efficient, and we've done a better job of raising the corn with less input, less fertilizers, less fuel, less trips across the field. Well, this year alone, just in 1 year, we're cutting our fuel costs in over a third. And, you know, but still, they're the same thing. We're still back at $2 corn, and these plants are not big plants. If you see an ethanol plant today, see the amount of ethanol it can produce physically. It's not a monster. It's not a humongous eyesore. These ethanol plants, but I think the idea here is these guys are saying that, you know, we're on the tip of something very, very big, and the other benefits between carbon dioxide and the other gases, those kind of things, this is something very good for the environment. It's great. It's great for America. It's great for the world. You know, and I just think that we all just need to get together and work. And the car manufacturers are turning the corner and producing cars that we're wanting to buy that are more efficient, that'll burn these renewable fuels. And I think it's just great for America.
Well, I appreciate the comment. We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, at that for the moment. I'm sure that we'll get back to some of these subjects on future programs. But for the moment, we'll have to leave it there and say thanks to our guests. Stephen Long, he's professor of plant biology and crop science. Weeman Joe is assistant professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering. And Hans Blaschek is professor of food microbiology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, right here where we are.